is for the way you look at me. O is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore. And love is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two, when love can make it, take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you.
Welcome to Sup Media Reviews, the podcast that never needs spoiler alerts because it takes you back in time to relive the nostalgia of classic TV shows and films that you've probably already seen. I'm your host, Kiara, and each week I'll dive into the archives to bring you my take on movies and TV shows from at least 20 years ago. From cult classics to forgotten gems, I'll review them all and give my honest opinion on their impact and whether or not they still hold up today. Join me as we revisit the iconic characters, memorable moments, and timeless themes that made these shows and films so special. So take a break from adulting and get ready for a trip down memory lane with Sup Media Reviews. What is up, Home Slices? Thank you so much for tuning into Sup Media Reviews. I'm your host, Kiara, and it is March, Women's History Month. This month, we are reviewing and celebrating women-led movies and TV shows from different genres. Last week, I reviewed Scream from 1996 with a special guest. Check it out if you haven't already. But this week, we're going to be reviewing a kind of comedic romance from my childhood, the 1998 film, The Parent Trap. This remake of the 1961 Disney movie of the same name features Lindsay Lohan as Hallie Parker and Annie James, Dennis Quaid as Nick Parker, Natasha Richardson as Elizabeth James, and Elaine Hendricks as Meredith Blake. Now, in my research, I actually learned that the 1961 movie was based on a 1949 German children's book. I'm probably going to butcher the title of this book, but it is called Das doppelte Lobchen by Erich Kästner. Did you all know that this was actually based on a book? And the book has a little bit of history that involves, I'll say, World War II. So if you're interested in that type of stuff, you might want to check it out. This movie was the feature film introduction of Lindsay Lohan, and hats off to her for playing her own twin. So today we are going to be celebrating her as a very young lady doing her thing in this movie. Now, before we move on, I want to plug next week's episode because a special guest is going to be joining me to review the 1995 film Waiting to Exhale. We're still going to be celebrating Women's History Month, and what better way to do it than to review an iconic movie with an ensemble female cast and an all-women soundtrack, okay? Make sure you all follow, like, and subscribe to be notified when new episodes are released. Now back to the show. Here are some fun facts about The Parent Trap. Now, an oddity for a Disney film, this movie shows a mother smoking a cigarette and getting deliberately drunk. We also get a little 11-year-old girl taking a little sip of wine too. So there's a few little things in this movie that may not necessarily be appropriate or that are commonly seen in children's movies, which is actually quite interesting. Now, for the next fun fact, for her split screen scenes, Lindsay Lohan wore an earpiece, which would play back the dialogue of the other sister. You all, it takes real talent to play two characters, especially at such a young age. Lindsay Lohan, I know we have seen her go through like a number of things in the media or whatever, but it does not take away from the fact that she is super talented. And we'll actually go into a little bit more about how she was chosen. Now, to find the actress who would play Hallie and Annie, the two main characters, an exhaustive casting search was conducted in Boston, Chicago, Minneapolis, Atlanta, Miami, Vancouver, Toronto, and London, with open calls in New York and Los Angeles. Lindsay Lohan was 11 years old when she pretended to be ill so she could skip school and go to her first movie audition for this movie. Mara Wilson, who you may know as the little girl from Matilda, auditioned for the dual roles, but was ultimately passed over because producers felt she wasn't old enough to play the parts. Some of the additional actresses that were up for the role with Scarlett Johansson, Alex McKenna, Michelle Trachtenberg, and even Tina Maharino. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but you may know her as Deb from Napoleon Dynamite. You all, Napoleon Dynamite is my favorite movie, and it actually turns 20 this year, and I'm so excited to review it. Y'all don't even know, okay? But these young ladies also tried out for the lead role in this movie. Jenna Malone, who's a pretty popular child actress, turned down Lindsay Lohan's role 3 times. Writer and director Nancy Myers eventually picked Lindsay Lohan to play the dual role of the twins in the film and called the Lohan household herself to inform the actress that she had landed the part. So they went through an extensive search to find someone, and I think they found the right person. Now, if you want to check out The Parent Trap from 1998, you can watch it on Disney Plus as of the recording of this episode. Now, here's the part where we get into my personal connection to this film. When I was younger, I remembered loving this movie. It was Disney, it was super cute, and because I had no real like concept or recollection of the original 1961 movie, this story felt new to me. I thought Lindsay Lohan was super pretty and talented, and I really loved her red hair. And like, who doesn't love a good story about twins being separated at birth and being brought back together, all right? And the whole shenanigans that go along with trying to switch lives with each other. If you're into twin stories, I did do a review recently of Sister Sister for Black History Month, so make sure you go and check that out as well. Now, as a person whose parents didn't stay together, there is something about watching these two sisters reunite their parents that feels like an unrealistic and delusional void in my life. So I identify with that part of the movie as well. Now, I think the thing that I really loved about this movie was how fun it was, like particularly while the girls were at the camp and how the main characters, Annie and Hallie, like took charge of their lives and like orchestrated a love story that included destroying a would-be evil stepmother, right? Like, who doesn't love a happy ending in that way? Seeing these sisters interact and learn about each other and connect with their long-lost non-custodial parents is actually pretty fun, despite being an unusual family configuration. And we'll talk more about that later. But you all, prior to watching this movie for this review, I hadn't watched it in over 10 years, maybe in over 15 years. So I'm really excited to dive in and talk about The Parent Trap. We open the movie with Love by Nat King Cole. We all know this song. L is for the way you look at me. And so that song plays in the background while we see some glimpses of the wedding ceremony of Elizabeth James, who is listed as an artist, and Nicholas Parker, who is a viticulturist. I don't know how to pronounce this word, but the two of them got married on January 8th, 1986 at the ages of 23 and 24, respectively. Apparently, a viticulturist is a person who grows grapes for winemaking. So I didn't realize that on marriage, because the reason why I'm giving you all these details is because on their marriage license, it lists their age, the date, and their professions. Now, I have a marriage license. I don't have it on me or nearby, but I'm like, does my marriage license list a career? I don't know. Anyways, these two people got married at a relatively young age, right? They were married on a boat. It looks like a small cruise liner called the Queen Elizabeth II. And it looked like this wedding was like a little expensive because this cruise ship was fancy, okay? And they had like world-class servers and everything, right? And throughout the movie, I'm going to talk about how rich these people freaking were. And how that actually plays a very pivotal role in this story, right? So anyways, there were fireworks on the ship to celebrate this wedding. The overall theme is that this wedding was lovely and the couple was super happy and in love. And at the end of the scene, a photographer takes a photo of the happy couple at their wedding. And we see that photo of, you know, these two people in front of a lifesaver that has the ship's name on it. The photo, of course, becomes important later. So it's 11 years and 9 months later, and it's a sunny day at Camp Walden in Maine. It's the first day of summer camp, and busloads of preteen girls and one boy buzz about gathering their luggage and finding out where they're supposed to be. Marva Culp is the camp director, and her daughter, who is also named Marva, aka Marvel Jr., is the second in command. Now, I've seen people name kids after themselves, both male and female, and I'm not really fond of this tradition personally. My husband is a second, and if we have a son, he wants to name him the third, and I'm like, not a super fan of this. Like, let your kid have their own identity. Also, like, who are you that somebody should just be named after you because, like, you're so great, I guess. I don't know. I don't get it. No offense if you're named after somebody or plan to name your kid after somebody. If I have a son, they will likely be the third for whatever reason, you know, much to my chagrin or whatever. But like, Why? But anyways, we meet Hallie Parker, who is from Napa, California. She makes fast friends with a couple of girls while she's trying to find her luggage, and we learn that she and her father own a vineyard. Now, Hallie and her new friends are in the Arapaho cabin, and Hallie asks if her new friends know how to play poker. This, of course, comes back later. Now, this is the second movie that I've reviewed where a summer camp has used Native American tribes to name their cabins. The other movie that I'm referring to was Friday the 13th. Now, what is up with summer camps and the appropriation of Native culture? I really don't get it. I don't get it, just personally. Let's do away with that, right? Okay, but anyways, just then a limo pulls up and we meet Annie James. She is a well-dressed girl with like an itemized checklist of all of the stuff she's supposed to have packed. She has lots of matching, very expensive looking luggage. It was very cute, actually. She has a British accent and she has an identical face to Hallie. Physically, the only distinctive thing about Annie is that her hair is long and kind of mid-back length compared to Hallie's shorter, like shoulder length hair. We find out that Martin, her butler, who has accompanied her to the camp, is pretty close with Annie. They have like this little secret handshake that they do to the tune of Soulful Strut by Young Holt Unlimited. Now, the crazy thing about famous instrumentals is that it's really hard to find to find out who wrote these songs. And this is one of those. Like, if I just say to you Soulful Strut by Young Holt Unlimited, you're not going to know what I'm talking about 9 times out of 10. But if I hum the tune, you'll probably know what it is. The song is great. It's actually like been used a lot, and I hope their families are still making a lot of money off of that song, because it's like a fantastic song that I've heard quite a bit over my lifetime. But yeah, it's super cute. Anyways, we also learn during this time that summer camp is 8 weeks. 8 weeks. 8 weeks. That's almost the entire summer, y'all. Anyways, this camp is pretty nice. It's clean. The girls even have uniforms that they wear at camp. I mean, then there's this brief moment where they're in like the mess hall getting food, and we think that the girls are going to come face to face and meet each other. But then Big Marva steps between them and she gets confused because they look like each other, but you know, she wasn't paying all of the attention. She ends up letting it go. But next up, we see that Hallie Parker has become like a fast champion at fencing, right? And so she's just knocking down the little kids like fencing and whatnot. And so when the counselor, Marva Jr., asks for someone to challenge like Hallie Parker, who is the champion, Annie walks up and accepts the challenge. Now, somehow, no one is kind of paying attention as Annie starts putting on her fencing gear, right? So they're like not facing each other. Nobody's really paying attention to looking at one person's face over the other. Eventually, one of them like puts on their helmet and so they can't see the other one. And so it's quite orchestrated in a way that they purposely won't kind of see each other. But eventually the challengers come face to face with the helmets on and again are not able to see each other. So the girls, like, they start fencing and then they start doing like fancy tricks and they keep saying touche a lot and they're like bouncing off of trees and they are so into fencing that they move quite a bit and they finally get to a point where they're like on a porch of a cabin and Annie gets the best of Hallie and fences with her until she falls into a large tub of water. And so when Annie offers her well manicured hand to help Hallie up, Annie pulls Hallie into the water with her. And so the spectators kind of arrive and they declare Annie the new champ and the counselor instructs them to shake hands with each other. And so at some point they both take off of their helmets and turn to face each other. And when they shake hands, we see this kind of magical moment of them realizing that they look exactly like each other. And the spectators are kind of noticing this too. So the girls are kind of like experiencing this magical moment of like meeting a doppelganger, and they both kind of play it off and it comes across as like a little embarrassing the way that they experience this moment, right? But then Hallie draws first blood by starting to make fun of Annie's looks, pretending to be unaffected by the fact that they looked exactly alike. So Annie responds with her own insults about her superior fencing skills and claws in her British accent, and so now they have a little bit of a rivalry, right? So each twin has like two little friends or minions or whatever that they hang out with, so they both have backup as this budding rivalry happens. So back at the Navajo cabin, Annie is taking everybody's poker money and Hallie arrives with a cute updo. I remember loving this little updo that she had on this particular scene. I don't know what it was about this updo that she had, but I just thought it was so cute. Now, I want to remind you all that Annie is the one that's from the UK. Annie from the UK. That'll be a good way for you to remember. Annie from the UK. And Hallie is from Cali. There we go. We're going to get them straight. Okay. Anyways, so Annie from the UK. Can you all tell that I just came up with that off the top of my head? It's not in my notes, but I'm going to try my best to remember. Annie from the UK is in the Navajo cabin with a bunch of girls playing poker and taking all the little kids' poker money, right? And so Hallie from Cali arrives with like this cute updo to play against her twin. So they're playing whatever. The stakes are super high. It appears that they might be all in. If you know poker, you know what that term means. But Hallie decides to raise the stakes even higher by betting Annie that whoever loses this hand must jump into the lake naked. So a very self-assured Annie from the UK agrees. So Annie has a straight flush, an ace through five of diamonds, which is a fantastic hand and almost unbeatable, until Hallie shows us that she has a royal flush in spades, which is ace, king, queen, 10 of the same suit. The odds of both of them getting such great hands in poker is almost impossible. It really is almost impossible, for real, y'all. But anyways, unfortunately, a royal flush beats a straight flush, and Annie has to jump into the lake naked because she lost the bet. And so the girls, Hallie and her friends, run off with her clothes. So now she's kind of like naked outside in the darkness. And so Annie wants revenge, right? So next up, it's a new day. And when Hallie and her friends return to their cabin after a day of doing activities, their beds, luggage, and furniture are on the roof of their cabin. How is this possible? Also, a makeshift British flag is hanging up so that there's like a little calling card or whatever. And it's like, how is that possible? How did 11-year-old girls get furniture on the roof? We're going to let that one slide, but we can't let all of them slide. And we'll talk about why later. But the girls are basically in an all-out rivalry. Next up, it's nighttime, and Hallie and her friends break into the Navajo cabin where Annie and her friends and cabin mates are sleeping, and they do some Home Alone level plotting. We see some yarn and some honey and some chocolate sauce and, you know, some shaving cream, stuff like that, right? And so the next morning, when the Navajo cabin people, there's about five of them, wake up. First off, they wake up to the sound of bugle being played horribly. But when they wake up, they realize that their room is covered in yarn. Like there's yarn everywhere. There's that strung up from here to there. There's chocolate sauce on the floor. There are water balloons coming from the ceiling, a very large one that ends up landing on Annie. Again, Annie from the UK. I actually read in the fun facts that because of how large that water balloon was, they had to put a like thumbtack in Lindsay Lohan's hair to burst the balloon because the weight from the balloon could have given her a neck injury. And I was like, that's actually kind of interesting. I don't know why that's so interesting to me. But anyways, there's fake spiders hanging up. Somebody's completely covered in honey. Somebody has like shaving cream that's been fashioned into hair and like a little bikini. And I'm like, these girls have to be ninjas, absolute ninjas, to do all of this without waking anyone up, because Annie's cabin has like four other kids in it. So they didn't wake up any of those five kids while pulling together all of this stuff. Again, impossible. Impossible. We're just going to overlook this, I guess. But anyway, Hallie and her two minions watch as all of the chaos happens in this room, right? As everyone is waking up and realizing what's happening and that they're covered in sticky substances and there's fake spiders and whatnot. And so Hallie and her friends watch it all from outside of the cabin. They're kind of admiring their work, right? And then suddenly the Marvas come up to do an inspection, like a surprise inspection of the cabins, right? They got to make sure that people are keeping their cabins clean. Ain't nobody sick. Ain't nothing nasty going on, all that stuff. So they get ready to go into the Navajo cabin, and Hallie tries really hard to stop Marva Sr. from entering the cabin because there's a large bucket of chocolate sauce that has been rigged to the front door as like the coup de grace of the whole sticky bandit situation. And so Annie from the UK is inside the cabin saying like, hey, everything's kosher in here, unless, you know, Hallie from Cali knows something that I don't. Y'all should just go ahead and come right in. And so when Marva does come in, Big Marva comes in, the large bucket of chocolate sauce tips over and lands on both Marvas. And so because everything is so sticky and wet and they kind of slide across the floor and end up triggering another booby trap that turns on the ceiling fan that releases a bunch of feathers on top of all of the sticky substances. Now, as a child, I love this type of like shenanigans, right? Like these little tit for tat, you do this, I'm gonna do this back types of shenanigans, right? Between these, you know, unknowingly twin sisters, right? They got a little bit of a rivalry going. But now I have a couple of little issues. I feel like their rivalry kind of escalated a little bit out of nowhere. Hallie comes across as like unnecessarily mean by instigating a beef because she was mad that she got beat in fencing. And it's like, girl, does your curiosity not get the better that you would start asking questions instead of insulting someone who looks just like you? It doesn't make sense. And it's like they kind of fabricated this rivalry a little bit, right? And second, the more escalated stunts seem impossible to pull off. Like, how did 11-year-olds get furniture on the roof or rig a complicated network of booby traps while 5 children were asleep in a cabin? Like, it's totally unrealistic, okay? But because of all of the shenanigans that keep happening between these two girls, Marva orders Annie and Hallie to pack their bags. And no, they are not going home. In the next scene, we see the Marvas, along with all the other girls in the camp, marching to the isolation cabin, where the two of them will be together all by themselves. Now, this is supposed to be a punishment because summer camp is supposed to be full of social activities, making friends, spending time outdoors, doing fun activities, being creative, all of that good stuff. Personally, I low-key wouldn't mind being in a 2-person cabin than being with like a bunch of other kids getting sweaty and nasty in the woods. But it looks like the girls also can't participate in like the mini camp activities. So they're really on like time out. And the fact that they don't really get along, they aren't really having a good time. So while it seems a little more ideal for somebody like me who may not want to be around kids and getting sweaty and musty all day, for these two, this really is a punishment because they don't like each other and they are in timeout, right? So on this particular day that we see now, it's raining, it's windy, and Hallie is trying to hang up pictures in the cabin, but then the wind comes through and blows like her pictures all over the place. And so the twins kind of have to work together to close the window. So it is Annie who comes over to help Hallie. So Hallie seems delighted and surprised that Annie pitched in and helped her with the window. So for the first time, they have a kind of like non-contentious conversation and we learn more about the twins. We find out that they both eat Oreos with peanut butter. I low-key need to try that because that sounds amazing. And they both have a chat about their parents. Hallie shares a picture of her home, but in the picture, her dad is facing away from the camera. Annie reveals that she does not know her dad and that her mom never brings him up. We also find out that Hallie doesn't know her mom and that her dad never brings up the mom. They also realize that they have the same exact birthday. And Annie realizes way before Hallie that all of this stuff is not a coincidence. They realize that they both have ripped pictures of their non-custodial parents, and when they pull out the pictures, they see that each one of them has the missing piece and that they are in fact twins with the same parents. They hug each other and they realize that they even have like matching lockets that they received upon their birth. The girls are excited and they're hugging Lindsay Lohan's body double. And they are too excited to really think about the level of betrayal that their parents forced upon them, okay? And this is another piece of the story that doesn't sit right with me. These young ladies are 11 years old and didn't know anything about each other or having a twin. And each of them does not know anything about their other parent. This level of dysfunction and secrecy would put anyone over the edge, let alone a preteen girl. So the fact that these young ladies don't seem to experience any real negative emotions besides like longing, it's freaking crazy to me. And I think this is part of either like the Disney magic or Disney delusion that we're just going to focus on the happiest piece and totally disregard the dysfunctional piece. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, right? Like, Each girl has missed out on the love of their other parent and a twin sister for 11 years, and it's really not cool. And I'm like, this probably will require some counseling to process. But again, because this is a Disney movie, we're going to omit the mental health piece and the family dysfunction piece, okay? Which is kind of interesting because I've already reviewed Princess Diaries. I freaking love that movie, and it's also Disney, right? And her parents, she's 16, so she is quite a few years older than these two girls. But we get to experience that 16-year-old angst that comes along with your family lied to you for your whole life, right? Like, that has some realistic pieces in it, right? About the negative emotions that she experienced. And the fact that these girls have almost no negative emotions about it is freaking crazy to me, okay? But anyways, the girls, after this revelation, rearrange the room so that their beds are right next to each other. We find out that the mom is a rising star wedding dress designer, and that neither parent ever really got close to getting remarried. So Hallie gets a bright idea that when camp is over, they should switch lives. Now, Annie adds that eventually the parents are going to have to switch them back and reunite after all these years. And reunite means they're going to get back together and we're going to be a big old happy family. So 11-year-old logic, that's it. So we get a montage to Do You Believe in Magic? Where the girls are teaching each other how to become the other twin. They review family members, home layout, secret handshake, and the isolation cabin kind of becomes a bit of a classroom for them. Reminds me a little bit of The Color Purple when Nettie was teaching Celie how to read, but that movie was full of negative emotions and and this one is not. Stark contrast, but sisters teaching sisters. That's what I'm trying to get at. So anyways, the thing that they have to really resolve, though, is that the twins don't 100% look like each other. There's two kind of issues going on, right? Annie from the UK has long hair and Hallie has more shoulder length hair, right? And so eventually Hallie has to cut Annie's hair to look like hers. And it's a little bit nerve wracking, but Hallie does a good job, which is almost as unrealistic as the furniture on the roof. Okay, an 11-year-old girl cutting your hair to look like hers and it coming out looking decent and not butchered at all and no real kind of like blunt cuts, that's unrealistic. But with this new haircut, Hallie realizes that Annie's ears aren't pierced as well. So now they have to pierce them, which is quite dangerous. Do y'all know how easy it is for a new piercing to get infected? When you're at camp, you don't have access to all the normal stuff that you have access to. The fact that she didn't get an infection is actually quite unrealistic too, especially considering the tools that they used to pierce this girl's ear. They had a match, a suspicious needle. I don't know where this needle came from or what kind of needle it was. An apple, an ice cube. Like, these are rudimentary. These are rudimentary tools, okay? They pierce Annie's ears and both the girls scream because this is freaking crazy, right? I actually remember this scene as a child. The ice in particular, I don't know why I recall that. But y'all, that's crazy that you go to camp and you come home with cut hair and pierced ears. We're gonna talk about that later too. Now, camp is over, y'all. I don't know how much time the girls spent hating each other versus how much time they spent in their isolation cabin. But over the course of the 8 weeks, they went from having this very intense rivalry to realizing that they are sisters and learning about each other and deciding to deceive their parents, okay? So at some point they turned things around and became, you know, sisters. And so it's the last day of camp and all the girls are saying goodbye. Annie and Hallie have switched clothes, they have switched lives, and each of them has a task that they need to do. The real Hallie from Cali will figure out how their parents met while she's in London, and the real Annie from the UK will figure out how the parents broke up. Now, the girls hug and they go their separate ways, right? And they are off to meet their non-custodial parents for the first time, like WTF. So things are going to get confusing from here on out because it's hard enough keeping track of the girls' names. So what I have decided to do is to refer to the girls as follows. Hallie, who is now pretending to be Annie, is going to be living with her mom in London. So I will refer to her as Mama Twin. Now, Annie, who is pretending to be Hallie and Callie, will be called Papa Twin. Okay, so each twin is going to be known by which parent they are meeting and connecting with for the first time, their non-custodial parent. Okay, so Hallie, who is pretending to be Annie in London is Mama Twin, and Annie, who is pretending to be Hallie in Napa, California, will be called Papa Twin. I hope that this is as clear as I can make it, all right? So Mama Twin arrives in the UK at the airport where Martin, the butler, meets her. She has a new look, her hair is shorter, and she has her ears pierced, but Martin doesn't really ask any questions. They do their secret handshake, which, you know, Annie taught Hallie. And all is well, right? Like, there's not too many red flags besides the change in appearance, right? So Mama Twin is in the UK taking everything in on the car ride home. We don't put enough weight to the fact that this girl flew across the pond to people that she does not know. This is a very bad, kind of dangerous situation in general. And we're just really kind of overlooking it, but whatever. So she's in the car in the UK for the first time, seeing all the sights, taking everything in, right? And so in the background, we hear, there she goes again. This movie low-key has good music, y'all. But okay, so Mama Twin starts to become nervous because she's anxious about meeting her mama for the first time. And I'm like, again, the gravity of this situation. A girl from California is in the UK with strangers, y'all. This could be taken for real. But anyways, when Mama Twin enters the house, there's a welcome home Annie sign, and she greets her grandfather, who is a sweet older British man that the Mama Twin ends up sniffing to make memories. It was a very weird moment. Now, the mom, whose name is Elizabeth, we might call her Liz or Lizzie for short, because Elizabeth, like, so many syllables. But Elizabeth, you know, is very happy to see her little girl, and they kind of run and hug each other, and the Mama Twin is overcome with emotion, and Elizabeth notices these physical changes, right? Cut hair and pierced ears, but she doesn't really trip over them. And I'm like, am I the only person whose parents would be mad if I came home with a haircut and with ears pierced? You should not have more holes in you than when you left. When you left for camp, you were minus two holes in your body. When you return home, you need to have the same amount of holes that you had when you left, okay? I feel like my parents would flip out if there was such a drastic change. They might make a phone call to the camp, and my jig would already be up because the camp counselors would be getting a mouthful, and the counselors might also reveal that there was an identical twin person who was also there. Yeah, this, see, with my Black parents, this story doesn't work. First off, I don't know that I would be able to afford to go to a camp that lasted 8 freaking weeks. And mind you, this camp is a great distance for both people. Someone flew from the UK to Maine, and then Hallie from Cali flew from California to Maine to go to this camp. What is so special about this camp? This is basically boarding school. Yo, this is crazy. And this is why I'm saying that, like, a big part of this story that they don't focus on per se, but that enables every action in this story, is the idea that both of these people are quite rich and provide their children with a more lavish lifestyle. So now the charade begins. A lot of things are going to happen that kind of hint that something is off, and the twins are going to have to figure out ways to explain them, right? So a lot of that kind of stuff is going to happen, right? So Martin finds a stuffed bunny named Cuppy in Mama Twin's luggage. It's actually Mama Twin's favorite stuffed animal, and she has to come up with a story on the fly about how it belongs to one of her fellow campers and how she will mail it to her. This is like a kind of a security blanket for her a little bit. Suddenly, Elizabeth gets a call from someone, and Mama Twin has to accompany her mom to the studio. So we get a little montage of them walking over to the Elizabeth James studio, where Mama Twin says that she would love to see her mom in an Elizabeth James original wedding gown that is displayed in the window of this store. So she has her own studio, right? And has a, like, a storefront window to display some of her work. And so there's a photo shoot going on at the studio, and Elizabeth has to come in and put a veil on a white top hat to complete the look for a dress that's being photographed. They called her and they were like, hey, we need you at the studio. And she goes in and they're like, hey, this veil is too long because it's hiding the dress. Like, what are we supposed to do? And so she puts the veil on a top hat, a white top hat, and it solves the problem. Part of me thinks that the top hat with the wedding dress is low-key, like, cool and innovative, okay? I've personally never seen any bride wear a top hat with a veil. I think that's kind of cute. But a different part of me feels like she was asked to leave her house and come to work for some BS. Y'all couldn't figure this out? Anyway, Mama Twin is so happy to see her mom in her element, and she thinks that her mom is really cool. And Mama Twin even joins in the photo shoot. So it was a cute little scene, right? So afterwards, Mama Twin and Elizabeth are walking, and Mama Twin is like laying it on really thick. She's asking her mom if her job makes her want to get married or even think of her father. Now, eventually, Mama Twin convinces her like suspicious mother to tell her more about her father. We find out that they met on a boat called QE2, the one that we saw earlier in the movie, which is short for Queen Elizabeth II. It's an ocean liner that sails from London to New York. It turns out that Elizabeth and her husband, or the father of her children, were both afraid to fly. At the time that they boarded the ship, they were single and they were seated next to each other at dinner on their first night cruising. We find out, y'all, that Elizabeth actually never even told Annie her father's nationality. Annie didn't know her father was American. How do you manage? How do you manage to withhold that amount of information from your child for 11 years? It's not that, you know, he died in a fire. He didn't want you. I went to the sperm bank. None of those like logical explanations. You just kind of avoid the topic for 11 years. Kids start asking questions way before that. The dysfunction here, we just ignore it. It's a kid's movie. I get it. Like, I didn't pick up on this stuff when I was younger. But I mean, come on. Like, who's watching this movie? The parents are watching it with their children. I mean, come on. Like, whatever. Next up, we are at the Napa Airport. It's a tiny airport, right? And so Papa Twin is greeted by her father, Nick, for the first time on the tarmac. Now, this is for sure pre-9/11 because of the way that this airport is set up, but we won't go into that. It's a sweet moment where, you know, she gets to embrace her father for the first time. And Nick seems to really love and dote on his little girl. He notices something is a little off about her, but he chucks it up to her getting a little taller. She has been gone for 8 weeks, and it makes sense to me that she might be a little bit taller, right? He hints that there have been lots of changes since she left 2 months ago. Now, look, I didn't mention this before, but let me know in the comments if you went to summer camp for 8 weeks. Like I said, I don't think that I will be able to afford to go to summer camp for 8 weeks. How much is 8 weeks summer camp? You know what? Let me look it up right now. Y'all. Okay, I took a brief second to look up if 8 week summer camps even existed, okay? And so the one that I was able to find relatively quickly is I'm again not sponsored or anything by this camp. There's a camp called Point O' Pines Camp, POP for short, POP, hold it down, which is located in Brant Lake, New York, and they have a 7 week program for 2024. It is from June 22nd to August 9th. So they'll be there the last week of June, all of July, and like a week in August. So that is about that 7 weeks. Tuition is $16,100. It's a girls' camp. What the heck? And then if you have like a young kid who's from first through fourth grade, they have a number of like limited spaces for 4 week sessions where you have the option to extend the camp for a full summer session. So like if your kid is too young and you don't think that you can be away from them or that they would be okay being away for 7 weeks, you can do a 4 week option. The 4 week option is $10,000. Y'all, I understand this is 2024 money. And if we, you know, go backwards to what that means in 1998, these aren't even 8 week camps. This is 7 weeks for $16,000. Y'all, this is almost unbelievable. $16,000. There's some colleges that like, you could probably get a semester or two for $16,000. You send your kid away for 7 weeks and spend $16,000. Y'all, that is crazy. That is crazy to me. I need to move on because that is crazy. Okay. Anyways, I have been to summer camp before. I feel like 2 weeks max. There's also things like day camps. I remember years ago, I think I was 14 years old. My dad and stepmother would go visit during the summer. And there was a place called Sun Valley Beach, which is basically like a water park that had like a day summer camp. So you could like hang out at the water park during the day. And we did activities. We did horseback riding. We did like a bunch of stuff. It was super fun. We could play in the water park when like nobody was allowed to be there. And also when other people would like pay to get in. It was actually a fantastic experience and I actually really loved it. But that only lasted for maybe a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks tops. And I have no idea how much it cost. No idea. But it was super fun and amazing. But 8 weeks? I don't know, being away from your parents for 2 months? Y'all, let me move on because my mind is just being blown, right? And again, like, This camp is so special that someone from California and a different person from London sent their kids there for 2 months. What in the absolute heck? It's crazy. This is a special kind of like alternate universe where these kind of coincidences and shenanigans happen, okay? You really kind of have to suspend your disbelief for this movie in a way that I really did not remember. But on the drive home in the beautiful wine country in Napa, we find out that the girls didn't write their parents at all. So the parents have no updates on what's going on with the kids. So there appears to have been absolutely no communication with the parents for 8 weeks. What even is that? You send your kid away for 8 weeks and have no communication with them? I don't know how these people do it. Anyways. A few oddities keep happening as they talk about her camp experience on the drive home, right? Like the twins have switched accents, right? So that they are not as noticeable. They've switched physical appearance, but there are just some things that are innate to you as a person that are not as easy to hide because they're really subconscious. And so Papa Twin is still using this kind of like London vernacular. She's saying things like lovely girl or horrid habit. And she keeps saying dad at the end of every sentence. She's overusing the word dad. And of course her father notices. Both of the girls have some tells, but their parents pretty much overlook it. Like, you haven't seen your kid in 2 months. Lots can change, apparently. Papa Twin does this monologue about how horrible it would be to grow up without a father. And that explains why she keeps saying dad. It's a poor explanation, y'all. Poor explanation. So they pull up to the house in wine country, right? It's a beautiful large house. It has this beautiful, like deep brown gingerbread color. Like the house could literally be made out of gingerbread, y'all. But a woman named Chessie, who's played by Lisa Ann Walter, and who you might recognize as Melissa from Abbott Elementary, greets the little girl enthusiastically. And right away, of course, Chessie noticed something is off too, but is too happy to really ask questions. She's just happy to see her girl back, right? So Chessie is like their domestic servant. That sounds worse. She works for the family. Jesus, butler sounds so much better than maid. Y'all, I don't know. Maybe it's just a me thing. I really don't know. Anyways, I mentioned this earlier, but the dad is played by Dennis Quaid, which to me, he's like, he always plays a dad. I don't know. He's an attractive guy and he's cool and I enjoy him. I enjoyed him in this movie. The mom is played by, I believe her name is Natasha Richardson. So yeah, I thought I would bring that up. Anyways, like I said, Chessie notices something is off and Sammy, the dog, who is a golden retriever, keeps barking at Papa Twin because he knows what's up. He's like, this ain't my girl. Who is this? Who is this stranger? She'd look like her, but she not her. She ain't you. Anyways, Nick goes outside with this someone, right? Because Nick is like, I'm gonna grab some cornbread and chili that Chessie made and I want you to meet somebody, right? And so when Nick grabs his food and he goes outside with this someone, it's like a lady in a white dress and a black hat, and she is clearly romantically involved with the dad. And the lady who's out there asks Nick if he told his daughter something, and we can already tell that bad news is coming. Now, up in Papa Twin's room, Chessie gives the lowdown on this lady and says that Nick is making a fool of himself with this woman. The lady's name is Meredith Blake, and she is a publicist from San Francisco that Nick hired to publicize the vineyard. Chessie thinks that Meredith has been selling herself more than the grapes and is only interested in Nick for his money. Nick is a millionaire who owns a bunch of land and some wine grapes and a winery. I mean, he's a catch, right? Now, Chessie does not seem like the type of person who holds her tongue, but I don't think that it was wise or even appropriate for her to poison the girl's mind against her dad's girlfriend before they even really had a chance to meet. And then she has the nerve to tell the girl, don't let me influence you. And it's like, Chessie, you done already poisoned the girl's mind against this lady. What do you all think about that? I feel like Chessie ended up being correct, but I don't think it's okay. I think some people just have to form their own opinions, right, about other people. So moving on, Nick introduces Papa Twin to Meredith by the pool. She is a 26-year-old blonde woman who's a smooth talker and only 15 years older than the twins. Papa Twin is not shy about pointing out the age gap, and Nick seems nervous that she's so focused on the math. And it's like, Nick, get a grip. I'm trying to figure out. Okay, here we go. Let's do some math. We know that at the beginning of the movie, Nick and Liz got married and they were 23 and 24. If they had kids right away, if they got pregnant right away, that would make mom 34 and dad 35. Huh. Dennis Quaid looked older than 35. I wonder how old Dennis Quaid was when this movie came out. Let me see. Okay, y'all, I did some quick math. So it appears that if they were not married for very long and they got pregnant right away, they would have been around the ages of 34 and 35. And I was like, Dennis Quaid looked older than 35. So I looked it up. In 1998, when this movie came out, Dennis Quaid was actually 44 years old. So he was playing someone that was about 9 years younger than he actually was. On the other hand, Natasha, who played the mom, was actually 35 playing a 34-year-old. So age appropriate. Anyways, Dennis Quaid, no way he looked 35. What the heck? Nobody does the math like me, I don't think, in these movies. But like, come on, don't try to pull the wool over my eyes. All right. Anyways, if you think about it, and if dad is supposed to be about 35-ish, marrying a 26-year-old woman, that is a 9-year age gap. Am I doing the math right? Yeah, a 9-year age gap. And personally, I think that's too much of an age gap, but I have seen relationships like that work. I feel like if your age gap is going to be like 9 or 10 years, the younger person needs to be at least like early 30s. But let me know if y'all think y'all have thoughts on like age gaps relationships. Personally, in general, not here for them unless both people are like in the upper age range. Like if you're 40 and you get married to a 50-year-old, that makes a little bit more sense than being like a 20-year-old getting married to a 30-year-old. Same age difference, but the level of maturity is a little bit different. I have a lot of opinions on that, some of that from personal experience, but I'm going to move on. Let's move on from that, right? So Nick leaves to grab a bottle of champagne to celebrate, and Meredith says that they are celebrating the girl's homecoming after she was away at camp. And it's like, that doesn't seem right, right? So like, if I'm 11 years old, do not celebrate me by drinking something that I cannot legally drink, all right? We having Kool-Aid jammers to celebrate me, okay? Anyways, as Nick leaves, Meredith, who is still acting as the publicist for this winery, gets a call from a reverend who is asking for Nick to participate in some type of charity event. Meredith lies to the reverend, stating that she's writing down the details and that Nick will actually be out of the country at the time of this charity event. Now, Papa Twin overhears this and realizes that Meredith's character sucks and that she doesn't even have any scruples about lying to a man of the cloth about a charity event. When Papa Twin asks her about the lie, Meredith classifies it as like a little white lie to get Nick out of doing something. Meredith tries talking to the Papa Twin and seems super focused on how close Nick is to his daughter. Papa Twin does a cannonball into the pool, getting Meredith wet, of course, on purpose, and things are already starting to heat up between them. Meredith seems really to be kind of like genuinely-ish, extending this like olive branch to Papa Twin, but the twin decides to weave a tale about her father being a ladies' man and that Meredith is number 29 of the women he likes to wine and dine, which obviously is not true because they already talked about him never really moving on with his, you know, romantic life after he divorced the mama. So later on, the twins have to chat with each other. They have to keep in touch. Papa Twin calls Mama Twin. There's this real brief suspicion as Martin the butler recognizes the similarities in the caller's voice, but they each go into a private space to provide each other with some updates on what's going in. Mama Twin starts to go off on how much she adores her mother and how much info she's gathered on how their parents met, but Papa Twin interrupts her because she has more important news. It's still only day one, and Papa Twin wants to move up the reunification effort because of Meredith, the monkey wrench in their plan. Okay. Mama Twin, though, wants more time in London with her mom and uses a candy wrapper to create static as a reason to end the call. The only advice Mama Twin gave was to use sabotage to get rid of this relationship. Now, as an adult watching this movie, I can honestly say that the American twin, Mama Twin, is a problem. Okay. She comes across as being selfish and vindictive, and she usually has to provoke her sister into responses, particularly when it came to camp. Briefly, Mama Twin ends up getting caught by her mom, Martin, and grandfather for being weird and taking calls in the closet, which she chucks up to tradition, whatever. So back in Cali, Chessie makes breakfast for Papa Twin, and more holes pop up in this facade, right? Chessie realizes that Papa Twin made a phone call at midnight and that the time difference excuse didn't make a lot of sense. Papa Twin's formerly voracious appetite is no longer there, and the dog is still like, girl, I don't like you. And Papa Twin forgets that the patio doors are actually push and not pull. So Chessie is becoming very suspicious about these changes in this child, which she should. Now, Papa Twin heads to her father's office where he's waiting to meet her to tell her some news, right? We see tons of barrels of wine that are sitting in a warehouse. We see a few people working. He got a whole little wine operation going, right? So both dad and daughter have things they want to talk about each other with. Nick wants to talk about Meredith, while Papa Twin wants to talk about her mother and learning more about her. Now, the conversation kind of comes to an end when Meredith shows up with her assistant, Richard, and it's clear that Nick has not revealed the news that he's been itching to share with Papa Twin. Nick and the twin are spending the day together. So Meredith pulls off in a golf cart with her assistant and tells him that once she's married to Nick, she plans to ship the girl off to boarding school in Timbuktu. So we got evil soon to be stepmother vibes. And literally the only reason we meet her assistant is so she has someone to make this revelation to. We do not see this man again. So next up, Nick and Papa Twin go horseback riding together, and we learn that they have a camping trip coming up. Apparently, they take this trip every year before school starts, but of course, Papa Twin, who is not the real Dorian, has to be reminded of this tradition. Nick gets serious, and he asks the girl what she thinks about Meredith. Now, Papa Twin tries to play dumb a little bit, but admits that the woman is a stranger to her, and ends up taking off on her horse right as Nick is about to reveal the big news. When Papa Twin runs back to the house, she's freaking out, and she's talking to herself in her normal British accent, but she doesn't see that Chessie is like in a wingback chair in the room. So when Chessie confronts her about what's up with all these strange inconsistencies, Papa Twin eventually reveals that she is actually Annie from the UK. Chessie is, of course, stunned and emotional and must hold back tears because Nick suddenly bursts into the room asking why Papa Twin took off on him. Nick realizes that something is up and Chessie is really emotional and she's hugging on the twin and she's offering to cook everything in the house. She's just very excited to see this child that she has not seen in like 11 years, basically. So Chessie leaves the room with happy tears, leaving Nick to share his news with Papa Twin. Now, at first, he asks what she would think about making Meredith a part of the family. And so the twin says that she's all for it since she always wanted a big sister. And I was like, that is hilarious. Okay. She was insinuating that Nick was going to adopt Meredith, which is hilarious. But when Nick asks about marrying Meredith, the twin rightfully freaks out over the age difference and the fact that they haven't known each other very long, and even speaks some angry French. And when they calm down, the twin ends up running off, saying him getting married is going to ruin everything. So she obviously is not happy with this, right? It's a very big monkey wrench in the plan to reunite the parents. And she is there alone. She is in a strange place that she don't really know. Lots of things are going wrong, right? So Meredith pulls up to the house with a bell in hand so that she can call for Chessie. And I'm like, WTF, how rude is that? How dare you ring a bell at me, okay? But Nick has a look on his face like, this is not gonna go over well. But Chessie answers the call to get them some drinks. And of course, she ain't happy about it. But Nick then goes on to tell Meredith that the twin didn't take the news well. And Meredith says it's normal for her to react that way. And I'm going to go talk to her. So Meredith pops over to where Papa Twin is. And the conversation doesn't go very well. Essentially, they both figure out what the other one is up to. The twin recognizes that Meredith is plotting on Nick because of his money and his possessions. While Meredith recognizes that Papa Twin is smart and willing to sabotage her relationship with Nick. They low-key kind of threaten each other. And while this feud is kind of crazy, I respect that they are both being pretty direct about what each of them wants. Also in this conversation, we realize that the wedding is happening in 2 weeks. What is it about being middle-aged that makes you so quick to get married? I don't understand that. Because realistically, if they didn't know each other, if Meredith and Nick did not know each other or weren't talking or weren't working together when Hallie left for summer camp, they would be getting married in like 10 weeks from the time they met and started dating and got engaged. It would be like a 10-week whirlwind. That's freaking crazy. That's nuts. But the advanced timeline, I don't get it. Anyways, back in London, the residence, the James residence, gets a fax. It's a picture of a dog with the caption that reads 911. Martin gets it off the fax machine and Mama Twin spots it behind his back while they're having dinner together and has to lean over to look at it and ends up falling off her chair. Now, interestingly enough, also in this scene, the mom lets Mama Twin take a sip of the wine, and she, of course, knows way too much about the flavor profile because she grew up on a winery. But I'm like, that's crazy that an 11-year-old in a Disney movie gets to sip some wine. What? Mama Twin makes an excuse to leave the house, and she uses a payphone to make a collect call to California, where she learns the news of their father's impending nuptials. Mama Twin says, you know, okay, this is for real an emergency, so I'm going to tell Mom in the morning, and the plan gets escalated, right? So right as Mama Twin is leaving this little, you know, the iconic London red phone booth, she runs into her grandfather, who takes her on a stroll in the park, where she is forced to reveal what's going on, right? So Mama Twin goes into her mother's bedroom later on to confess that she is Hallie and that she and Annie switched places after coming back from camp. And of course, Elizabeth is emotional and very understanding, saying that she has always loved her daughter and that she's happy to see her and be with her and experience her at this stage in her life. It's sweet. And even Martin is crying like a baby at them being reunited, right? And so they make a plan to fly back to Napa. And Elizabeth is like, don't worry, boo, I got you. I'll take care of everything, right? And it's like, where are the negative emotions? Elizabeth is not apologetic enough for me for pretty much abandoning one of her children. Mama Twin is not mad enough about being abandoned. Where are the negative emotions, y'all? I feel like that they would surface at some point, and in this movie they never do. It's very unrealistic, y'all. I don't understand. We quickly switch scenes to Elizabeth packing for the trip, and she is freaking out about having to see Nick Parker again. She clearly still has feelings for him. And long story short, Elizabeth is trusting that Mama Twin has already broken the news to her father, so he'll be expecting them when they arrive in California. Of course, this is not true, and Martin kind of calls the twin out on it, but doesn't say anything to Elizabeth. Martin agrees to come on a trip with them in a kind of family capacity, and even helps her pack a freakum dress to stun Nick, okay? And so they head to the airport and fly to Napa. Now we switch the scene to the Stafford Hotel in California, where Meredith and her parents are instructed to play nice for their rich soon-to-be son-in-law. And it's very gross. You can tell that her parents, you know, feel like marrying a rich man is really all the girl was supposed to do with her life, okay? But Nick arrives with the dog, Chessie, and Papa Twin. The dog hates Meredith, which is hilarious. We also find out that this prenuptial retreat was actually Papa Twin's idea. Go figure, right? So when introduced to Meredith's mom, her name is Vicky, she asks the girl to call her Aunt Vicky. And I'm like, okay, if they got married, Vicky would become the twin's step-grandmother. No way am I calling you Aunt Vicky. I'm gonna call you Grandma. Okay, anyways, moving on. Just then, Mama Twin, Elizabeth, and Martin pull up to the hotel, and Elizabeth is sloshed. She drank all the mini bottles of vodka out of nervousness, and Mama Twin is a little worried. She's like, okay, you're supposed to be, you know, reuniting with your long lost love, and you're not even in your right mind, okay? What's weird is that Martin is dressed like the male lead from Grease. It's very odd. I kind of don't get it, but Mama Twin realizes that she's in big trouble because of how things are kind of panning out, right? Because of course she did not warn Nick that her mother was coming. So things are going to get a little crazy, right? And so in a well done and rather hectic scene, everyone kind of misses each other in the lobby as they go their separate ways to their room, right? Like the dog finds the real Hallie, the mom finds the real Annie. It's a cute little scene, right? And so on his way up the elevator, Nick is with Meredith, but then he spots Elizabeth and is super shocked to see her. So Elizabeth goes upstairs where she hugs both the twins at the same time. And then she gives the girls a mouthful about not really telling Nick that she was coming. She's like, that man was stunned. Now, what's going on here? And why didn't he know I was coming? We also get like a brief little meet cute where Martin and Chessie connect for the first time while Martin is in a Speedo getting ready to go swim at the pool. Now, eventually, Elizabeth learns about the mom and dad reunification plan and that Martin and Chessie were in on the situation. Having adults back you up in your BS is not, is not appropriate per se. But in this film, I guess, I don't know. It's weird. Anyways, Elizabeth says, me and your dad not getting back together. And the only reason I'm here is to switch y'all back. Okay. Switch to birth. Okay. So in another weird scene, we get some switcheroo twin shenanigans and Hallie ends up meeting Meredith for the first time in the lobby. Now down at the bar, Elizabeth drinks a hangover cure that was made by the bartender and Meredith is sitting like a few seats down from her. So when Elizabeth signs her receipt for this hangover cure, Meredith realizes that she is the Elizabeth James, the famous wedding dress designer who's had some of her work featured in Vogue. Now, Now, Meredith is kind of gushing over Elizabeth and believes that it is fate that they met. Of course, she's getting married soon. She needs a wedding dress, like, kismet, right? So Nick, who's running around the pool looking for Elizabeth in a nice suit that he put on just for her. And while he's looking, he's accosted by Meredith's parents, who think that the hotel is actually a great venue for the wedding. Now, Nick spots Elizabeth across the way and makes his way over to her. But there's so many people there. He's like pushing people out of the way. He ends up ending the conversation with Meredith's parents abruptly. He ends up falling into the pool because of all the commotion, and he looks like a fool and is sopping wet when they finally say hi to each other. So Nick and Liz come face to face, and Nick asks for an explanation about why she's there. And then the twins pop up to reveal the stunt. And for the first time in 11 years, Nick sees both twins at the same time. And Nick is happy to see his non-custodial and custodial father. It's a cute little scene. He's not mad enough for me. Again, nobody's mad, but okay. Nick and Elizabeth talk alone while Lizzie gets ready to like dress a wound on his face. He must have injured his face when he fell into the pool. But they start talking, and Meredith interrupts them, trying to figure out how these two adults know each other. The twins pop up, startling Meredith, who is not expecting to see two of the same person. And Meredith and Nick reveal that Hallie has a twin sister that he shares with Meredith's new wedding dress designer. Her wedding dress is about to be made by Nick's baby mama and ex-wife. That's crazy, y'all. This marriage is already built on too many lies. This woman doesn't even know how many kids her fiance has because he withheld this information. This relationship is destined to fail. You got a gold digger who is marrying a rich man who ain't told him all the details about his life. It's not gonna work, y'all. The mom, the dad, and the girls later that night go out, and the girls are surprising their parents with like a little outing and a date, right? So they drive onto a pier where they reveal that they're having dinner on a yacht that has been made to look super romantic and like the Queen Elizabeth too. So they're kind of staging the night that their parents met. Chessie is the server, Martin is the sommelier, and the dinner setup is only for two. So the girls are like elsewhere on the boat kind of observing what's happening, right? We also learn kind of briefly, and I could be mistaken, that apparently Chessie and Martin worked on that ship back when they met. That's an interesting detail too. But anyway, for whatever reason, I feel like Chessie hints at the fact that they might have both worked on the ship. But when they met each other, it was like they had never met before. So I don't know. I don't know, y'all, because it makes sense to me that people on an ocean liner would kind of all know each other if they worked there. So maybe that's a detail that I kind of messed up. Whatever, moving on. Nick and Liz clearly are not over each other, and Chessie and Martin are having their own little love connection, which is also very cute. But Nick and Liz try to discuss the way their relationship ended, and neither of them really remembers the details. They discuss it, and it sounds like they had some type of disagreement, and she left and flew back home, and he did not follow her. He says that he didn't realize that he was supposed to follow her, and they just kind of split up and split the girls up, and neither of them is really ready to get into it. So they decide to put on a show for the girls, and that the past really isn't worth revisiting. The next day, Liz plans on leaving with Annie for London, and she and Nick work out an arrangement where they will trade the girls on holidays. The girls come to the lobby and make an ultimatum. Unfortunately, because the parents can't tell the girls apart, they are stuck with each other until they can figure some stuff out. The girls demand to go on a family camping trip together and that they will reveal their true identities when the girls get back from the trip. The parents fold like a cheap suit and end up packing up for a 3-day camping trip, and Meredith is not happy about it. Meredith might be a gold digging trollop, but she is right about her instincts on this one, okay? I don't know that I want my fiance going on a 3-day camping trip in the wild with his children and ex-wife either. I wouldn't be happy about that, okay? So a guilty Liz invites Meredith to come along with them, but ends up pulling an okey-doke and says that she isn't going on the trip, and that if Meredith goes with Nick and the girls, she'll be able to get to know her future stepkids. So yeah, old girl gets tricked into going on this camping trip, and she is just really not suited for camping. They're in the wild. They're climbing rocks. They're working their way towards the lake, which is where the campsite is. And Meredith is tripping, y'all. She's not having fun. She's tired. One of the girls is putting rocks inside of her Prada backpack and puts a lizard on her water bottle. Now, Meredith freaks out when she goes to drink the water. And of course, they're trying to figure out what's going on. The girls keep playing tricks on her or whatever. And one of the girls, of course, the mean one from California, puts the lizard on Meredith's head. Now, when Nick goes ahead to, you know, try to make it to the camp or whatever, Meredith threatens the little girls. And eventually the lizard makes its way to her mouth. It's just very mischievous. And I remember confusing this scene with the scene that had the newt in it. I think it was a newt or a salamander in Matilda. And I remember watching Matilda, which is actually episode one. It's the movie that I reviewed in episode one of Submedia Reviews, thinking that the lizard was going to find its way into Miss Trunchbull's mouth. And when it didn't happen, I was like, why did I think the lizard went in her mouth? And it was actually because I was thinking of this movie, The Parent Trap. Also, if the lizard went into Miss Trunchbull's mouth, she might have chewed it. I don't know. That's a crazy thought. Let me get back on track, y'all. Let me get back on track. Anyways, so they finally make it to the lake. It's late. It's dark outside. They're about to eat trout for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which is a food that Meredith does not consume. She hates it. She's getting bitten by mosquitoes because she was tricked into putting sugar water on her skin. And I was like, are mosquitoes attracted to sugar water? I don't know. I don't know that mosquitoes are attracted to sugar water. Am I tripping? I grew up in the South. Mosquitoes were everywhere, but I don't know that they were particularly attracted to sweet stuff. It didn't make sense to me. Anyways, the girls kind of have tricked her into doing like clicking two sticks together to protect herself from mountain lions, even though there are no mountain lions wherever they are camping. She decides that she's going to take a big sleeping pill and go to bed. She really is not enjoying herself. And let me tell you something. Camping is not for everybody, okay? I feel like there are a lot of people who go camping who really want other people to enjoy camping. And it's like, that is not for everybody, okay? Indoor plumbing is my friend. I'm not gonna poop in the woods. That's where bears poop, okay? I'm not doing that. Camping is not for everybody. So I don't even blame Meredith for not getting down with the whole camping vibes, okay? I really don't blame her. I blame her for a lot of stuff in this movie, but this one, I'm with you on it, okay? Now, once she goes to bed, their dad tells the girls to lay off, like stop the shenanigans. But of course, the shenanigans aren't over. That night, the girls drag a sleeping Meredith and her inflatable mattress into the lake. Now, there's something weird going on here because it appears that Meredith is sleeping in a separate tent from Nick. That does not make sense to me. Why wouldn't they be sleeping in the same tent together? Anyways, they pull her inflatable mattress from out of her tent onto the lake. Shenanigans, right? And she floats away. So I do want to point out that in general, like the CGI and the green screen effects of like when Lindsay Lohan is visible as both twins are generally good, but they look particularly bad while they're camping. Something about like not being able to get the lighting right and having to show the girls together outdoors as opposed to where the lighting can be more controlled makes a difference. I also don't really care for the body double situation because I feel like her body double has a different head shape. It's not synced enough. As a child, I didn't notice, but as an adult, of course, I can pick up on it. Overall, though, for this to be 1998, the effects are pretty good. And for years, I thought Lindsay Lohan was two people. Okay. So the next morning, Meredith wakes up with a colorful bird on her chest and she freaks out, realizing that she is in the middle of a lake. She falls into the water and I'm like, yo, this is actually very dangerous. I don't know that the girls are aware if this woman can swim or not, but this is totally dangerous. And it's exactly how Jason Voorhees died. No, I'm kidding. Meredith reaches the shore and she's over it. She allows her mask to slip a bit and declares that as soon as they get married, she is shipping the twins off to Switzerland. And then she gives Nick an ultimatum and says, it's them or me. And of course he picks his daughter. It's like, come on, like, duh. Nick and the girls come back from camping early without Meredith, and the girls have been punished, in air quotes, for their treatment of Meredith. We then learn that Liz was low-key in on it and kind of purposely suggested that Meredith go on the trip with them. I think she knew that Meredith just wasn't right for Nick and was like, we need to do him this favor, right? Okay. And so Nick sends the girls to their room, but he tells Liz that eventually he's got to remember to thank them one day. And I think that's a really interesting parenting technique. Like, you punish them in the moment for being mean and possibly murdering this lady if she was not able to swim. So they got to be punished. But Meredith, of course, broke things off with him, which is what he is grateful for. Don't know that it balances out. And I do think that there are times where parents will tell a child years later, like, I punished you in the moment, but it turned out to be a good thing. I'm curious if any of you have ever had any of those experiences. I thought that was quite interesting. But anyways, Nick and Liz are talking a little bit and they realize that Chessie and Martin are off and have been gone for like a day and a half. So who knows what they're doing. So Nick is like, I'm gonna make some pasta, right? And so he has a private dinner with Liz. So Nick and Liz are talking, they're chatting, they go down to the wine cellar where Nick shares his wine collection with Liz, including a bottle of the same wine they drank at their wedding back in 1986. He has every bottle that was ever made of this particular wine. So, of course, Liz gets like a little misty-eyed, right? And right as they're about to kiss, Chessie and Martin pull up, killing the momentum. Liz backs away because she is unwilling to go there with Nick again. There's this weird brief exchange about where Nick tells Liz, like, hey, you don't have to be so brave all the time. And she's like, yes, I do. And I'm like, girl, what are y'all talking about? What act of bravery is she doing right now? I have a problem with the romance piece of this movie because it's not convincing enough for me. What is she being brave about? I don't understand. Maybe I'm tripping. Maybe I don't know enough about love. If y'all get it, tell me. Okay. Anyways, they end up leaving the cellar and nothing kind of happens, right? So it's the next day. It's time for them to say goodbye. The weather is awful. It's raining. I mean, duh. Like at the end of all these movies, it has to be raining, right? The twins, Chessie and Martin and Nick and Liz have to part, right? So there's a kiss on the cheek that Nick gives to Liz and all the London crew heads out, right? So the crew who's going to London land and the weather there is awful too. And everybody's all sad. And so Annie and Liz get home. And they start, you know, looking around trying to find Grandpa. But Hallie is actually already there at the house stating that the Concorde gets you to London in half the time. And I was like, girl, what you talking about? What is she talking about? So I looked it up. The Concorde was the first supersonic passenger carrying commercial airplane. And on its fastest flight on February 7th, 1996, the plane flew from New York to London in less than 3 hours. What the heck? That actually sounds super cool. I feel like I would throw up on that flight. I didn't look into like why that doesn't exist anymore, but there's probably a very good reason why a supersonic commercial airplane doesn't exist anymore. Being able to go from New York to London in 3 hours is crazy. I might have to look into it some more because it's actually quite interesting. Anyways, it sounds awesome. Nick pops up and he says that he didn't want to not come after her again. Like he already made that mistake once and he wanted to let her know that he was willing to chase her or follow her, or it sounds creepy when I say it, but he didn't want to make the same mistake, right? And so Liz is thinking all logical and she's like, how are we going to have a bicontinental relationship and figure out, you know, to take our daughters from here and there and everywhere, and you expect me to just fall into your arms? And Nick is like, yeah, I got you, boo. And so they make out and of course she falls and melts into his arms. And I'm like, this is supposed to be romantic, but something about the way they are reuniting and re-exploring their connection feels incomplete to me. And I cannot put my finger on it. I think people just kind of fall in love too easily. And I think movies and media can play a role in what it means for people to fall in love and like what that takes. I don't know that they have really explored who they are now, 11 years post-divorce, to know that they could really be in love with each other. Again, this is a Disney movie and they don't have to go into super detail about it. It just doesn't feel super convincing to me. And I guess that's okay because this is a children's movie, right? But anyway, the girls are happy and excited that they got their parents back together. And so the next scene, the final scene of the movie, is done in the style of this kind of like scrapbook. And so in the scrapbook, we see photos of Nick and Liz's second wedding, which is apparently on the Queen Elizabeth II as well, where Liz is wearing, if I remember correctly, the dress or a version of the dress that was in her studio window earlier in the movie. And all the people they care about are in attendance at this wedding. In the background, we hear Everlasting Love by Natalie Cole. This will be an everlasting love for me. So this is cool for two reasons. This is the song that me and my husband played at our wedding after we said I do. So once we left the ceremony, this is the song that was playing. Also, we started the movie with the song Love by Nat King Cole. L is for the way you look at me, who is Natalie Cole's father. So that's pretty neat. We start the movie off with a Nat King Cole song. We end the movie with a Natalie Cole song. It's cute. So in the photos, the couple looks so happy. We also see Martin propose to Chessie at the wedding. Do y'all have feelings about that? Do not propose to nobody at my wedding. Do not make a pregnancy announcement, a gender reveal. Do not make my wedding about you. That's how I feel personally. Okay, anyways, we see more pictures while the credits roll, and it is a happy ending, right? Like, everyone's reunited and it feels so good. So that's the end of the movie, y'all. At the end of every review, we ask the same questions. Is it worth a rewatch, and does it hold up today? Now, for whatever reason, I feel a little more hesitant to answer these questions than in most reviews. Can't really put my finger on why. If you really loved this movie as a child, I think that it is worth a rewatch, okay? It is very nostalgic. And if you feel a closeness to this film, rewatching it will give you a new perspective on it, because I know that's what happened for me. If not, if this movie means nothing to you, if you never saw it, don't bother. That's the way I feel about it, okay? As far as this movie holding up, I'm gonna say kinda. And I'm gonna say that for a few reasons, okay? There are a number of things that happen in this movie that don't feel realistic or healthy to me. Some of the shenanigans were quite unrealistic. The crazy poker hands, furniture on the roof, Home Alone booby traps, being okay with your kid cutting their hair and pinching their ears at camp, allowing so many inconsistencies about your child to be swept under the rug, putting a woman's bed in a lake, among others. Now, as a child, I didn't mind this kind of like hyperbole, but now I feel like a little bit annoyed by it, like just a little bit. And some of these things are particularly unsafe, right? And maybe kids shouldn't be doing these things or thinking about doing these things. This movie could stand to be a little bit more accessible in more ways than one. These kids are rich, y'all. The amount of disposable income and successful entrepreneurship that these families have is completely germane to the story of how the parents met and were able to afford a ocean liner cruise from London to New York, right? And then also able to afford an 8-week camp for their daughters. Again, we looked up the price for a 7-week camp and it was $16,000. Like, what the heck? The travel arrangements of how many flights and things that these people took just in this movie alone. It's totally unrelatable when it comes to class and income, personally. Now, all of that is small and can be overlooked pretty much. But the biggest part of why this story doesn't hold up for me is that the amount of secrets and dysfunction in this family results in absolutely no real negative emotions or consequences. How dysfunctional is it to raise a twin apart from their sibling and their other parent and never bring it up to that child? And nobody got mad. Nobody. Not the grandpa, not Chessie and Martin. Nobody got mad. Nobody. Nobody went to a family therapy session. There's no real hardship. There's no negative consequences, not even a real punishment for the girls who tricked each of their parents into kidnapping their non-custodial kid. This movie glosses over some of the really glaring issues that would absolutely warrant an emotional breakdown, legal action, and or mental health intervention, okay? It feeds into the fantasy that if the kids want something and can manipulate the adults in their lives to get it, all is well. This is not like a positive lesson for children to be learning. And again, I know that like the target audience at the time can't think this critically about the stuff and how much of a kind of fantasy it is, but I can't get down with it today. I just can't, right? And like I said, this movie is supposed to be a romance film, but again, it feels more like a fantasy. Like, and speaking of romance, the story kind of fell apart for me when it came to the reunification of the parents. Two things. They made it seem like Liz was being too tough or too proud or maybe even too masculine to accept Nick's love. And it also felt like the only reason they reconnected is because they have unfinished business together. And I get that this story is supposed to be primarily about the twins, but they could have gone a little harder on convincing us that the parents were legit falling back in love with each other. That part of the story just wasn't very convincing with me. I also realized that I didn't like Hallie, the American twin. She was kind of mean. But on a positive note, I actually enjoyed watching this movie. It was so nostalgic for me, like crazy nostalgic. Lindsay Lohan did a fantastic job in both roles. Everyone in this movie is a fantastic actor. The journey from the camp to the reuniting of the parents is quite fun. It's a story that's pretty well told. And even though this movie is on the longer side, it didn't feel super long to me. And so it was entertaining. I also like got to relive a story from my childhood with an actress that I kind of grew up with, right? And so while I wasn't a super fan of the body double situation, most of the visual effects held up with a few exceptions. For 1998, the effects are quite decent. Now, Meredith, who was played by Elaine Hendricks, was actually a really good villain. And we love a good evil stepmother, y'all. And she's actually the best kind of would-be stepmother because she showed her true feelings before the wedding, okay? We stand a queen that will stand on business, okay? She was hiding it at first, but then she couldn't do it anymore, and she did the right thing, and it worked out for everyone else. She might be the hero. Hell, I don't know. Anyways, overall, this movie is really focused on the positives and eliminates the negatives. So if you want a fantasy romance that's orchestrated by two really bold world-traveling 11-year-olds, this story is for you, okay? Now let's get into the ratings. The critics gave this movie an 87% while the audience gave it 70%. Now I feel surprised that there is a 17-point difference between what the critics gave it and the fact that the critics gave it higher praise than the audience. Now I would probably place this movie somewhere in the middle of those two numbers, around 75%, for all the reasons that I listed earlier. Now while this movie was super nostalgic and had a happy ending, the story really glazes over the dynamic emotions young girls would have after being betrayed by their parents for their entire lives. They could have infused a little bit more preteen angst for me to make it a little bit more realistic. Overall, the movie was entertaining. It was nostalgic, but again, I had a few problems with like the believability. But thank you all so much for listening to my review of The Parent Trap from 1998 here at Sup Media Reviews. Let me know what you think about this movie. Does it hold up for you? Did you rewatch it recently? Share your thoughts with us on our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Next week, we'll be continuing our Women's History Month series with a review of the 1995 blockbuster Waiting to Exhale, featuring Whitney Houston, Angela Bassett, Loretta Devine, and Layla Rashawn. You don't want to miss it. Peace out. Thanks for listening to Sup Media Reviews. I hope you enjoyed our trip down memory lane just as much as I did. If you have any suggestions for movies or TV shows you'd like me to review next, or if you just want to share your thoughts on today's episode, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest at Sup Media Reviews and on supmediareviews.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps me improve the show and spread the word to new listeners. So until next time, peace out, home slices.